This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. We just had some traffic issues.
You had some Helen issues.
Sorry
be
about
honest.
The delay. before we get started, I just wanted to respectfully acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and the elders from other communities who may be here today. And I'd also like to note that we have an Auslan interpreter today from Auslan Stage Left, Anna, over here. And so if you do require an Auslan interpreter, there are seats up the front for visibility. So who am I? I'm Hannah McCann, and I'm a lecturer in gender studies at the University of Melbourne. I teach courses on feminism, queer theory, sex, power and affect, all those exciting things. And my research work to date has focused largely on the queer femme community within LGBTIQ communities. I have a book that's due really soon, and it's really stressful. It's called Queering Femininity, Sexuality, Feminism, and the Politics of Presentation. But recently,
that's got bestseller written all over it.
It's one of those things that's going to cost like $1 million when it comes out, so I really apologise in advance.
I should also say on a personal note, I think she's very clever and occasionally quite funny. You may know her Judith Butler explored through the medium of cat cartoons, which is on her website, binarythis.com.
Yeah, thanks for the plug.
Hannah and I sort of coincide on a number of issues. We are occasionally in furious disagreement, but she's one of my little crèche of preferred millennials, which is why. And fuck me, those millennials, we can't say those things, older fellows, about their soy, avocado, latte, lube or whatever anymore. Look at them coming out for Jeremy in England. I'm sorry.
You are cutting way to the chase. If anyone doesn't know, this is Helen Razor.
Sorry.
So today we're here to hear from Helen, and as you probably know, Helen's been a broadcaster, is now a writer and a prolific social commentator. She was a host on Triple J for much of the 90s, which was my whole, you know, you were
a zygote.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. She writes now for many major newspapers and publications,
including Crikey. No major newspapers.
Okay, sorry.
They've all sacked me.
Well, they're sacking a lot of people.
I don't
write
for anybody publicly listed, which is not so much a strong socialist decision. It's just that they chucked me out.
Still, lots of important publications like Crikey, Daily Review, The Saturday Paper.
Well, anything clearly that bears my byline is important.
Yes, as we will learn tonight.
I'm joking.
I need to just plug your other book. In 2014, you published A Short History of Stupid with Bernard Keane, which is also available for sale, along with this book that we're specifically talking about tonight, The Helen 100, How I Took My Waxer's Advice and Cured Heartbreak by Going on 100 Dates in Less Than a Year, which charts Helen's adventures in dating after a devastating breakup.
Devastating.
It is devastating.
I'm a husk of a woman.
And her resolve to go on 100 dates in a year. So thanks so much for being here tonight, Helen.
No, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm so sorry to keep you waiting. It's Brazil and Argentina playing at the G. Because I am a writer, I live in where I can just about afford the rent. And my heavens, it took forever. And thank you so much for coming, by the way. And this one, she's good. She is good. What she neglected to say is that I am basically a perimenopausal loudmouth with no moral authority whatsoever. That's really a better designation.
It was next on the list, but I thought, you know, what we could do for... I'm not sure how many of you read the book yet. You should absolutely buy it at the end if you haven't read it. But let's kick off with an excerpt from the book.
Yes, all right, let's. Hannah requested this. She wanted me to read something really, really filthy, so I'll read something slightly less filthy. This is in the book after I've basically been covered in barbecued chicken grease, cat hair and my own misery on the floor for a couple of days. I found, because I was in a same-sex relationship, I found when that same-sex relationship ended that some of my friends, some of my social circle were very depressed about the fact that they had a little lesbian pet in their midst, and then did no longer. So this is my fascinating rumination about that. Although I am attempting, wherever possible, to universalise my experience for the sake of the broader dumped population, I should admit that my sensitivity to the whole lesbian issue, I should say this is just after I'd been speaking to blokes online and I had my designation on those dirty sites as bisexual, and they were like, "Are you a lesbian?" and getting very, very excited about it. And I was thinking about what that meant. I should admit that my sensitivity to the whole lesbian issue is probably pretty specific to me. Please forgive this indulgence and those many to follow. That my particular desertion happened to be of a homosexual flavour really intensified my shame and my impatience with views on sexuality generally. Lesbians are really not supposed to break up these days. They're supposed to stay together forever and provide an inspiring liberal example to others. And this notwithstanding, my actual intention to stay together forever was an attitude that really ticked me off. Regularly washing the socks or licking the vagina of another woman are seen largely as acts of moral leadership in the West. If there is one thing now more socially shameful than being part of a homosexual relationship, it is being expelled from a homosexual relationship. Almost no one, save for parents and preachers, hopes for the end of a homosexual relationship anymore. So many people expect us to be so damn good, as evidenced when I changed my Facebook relationship status to single. I did wait an entire half hour following the ex's departure to do this. And someone messaged me to say, "That's a shame, you two were so inspiring." I unfriended them. I've never been comfortable with or tolerant of the belief that anyone, especially me, can serve to genuinely inspire others. Like my old history teacher, Mr. Dean, I do not think that good or bad things spring from good or bad people. I believe they are produced by the mechanism of history. And I believe that historically it's an awful time to be a homosexual. At some point, gay became the new beige, and we are today the class doomed to revive the discarded dream of marriage. We are the people charged with the conspicuous carriage of rainbow babies in expensive baby slings. Ours are the animal libidos that must now be concealed behind a whopping great flag that reads family and love. We can no longer really cry for any rights other than those that would see us domesticated and neutered and compelled to give our desire a single name or possibly sent to the army. Anyway, people like to see us freaks in pairs. This has always got on my tits, but for obvious reasons, never quite so much as it did that first Dark Knight. There we go. There's a little bit of... You don't have to applaud. Applaud my indulgence. Do buy it, however.
So it's really interesting to hear you talk about the shame, I guess, of breaking up from a homosexual relationship. I too am in a homosexual relationship.
Oh my God! Call the cops.
I really hope I don't get expelled from it. But just to my girlfriend out there, if you're listening. So why do you think it's the case that there's this kind of pedestal, I guess, that's been set up for gays?
I don't know if you've noticed in the last few years, there's homosexuals are kind of fetish objects, and I don't mean that in a sexual way. I mean that in the old sense of the word fetish, people who undertake homosexual acts, even if they don't necessarily identify as LGBTIQA blur, whatever the big rainbow sandwich designation is these days, that they're seen as you kind of like your magic entryway for many liberal thinking people to tolerance. And you do get invited to more things if you're part of a say, like within a particular class, of course. As I said, you know, your parents might not like you. Furiously religious people might not like you. And, not only am I a Marxist, but I'm a Groucho Marxist. I never want to be part of a club that would have me as a member. And to be celebrated for one's identity category strikes me in some ways as being as repulsive as being reviled for it, you know, like that thing, you know, like some of my best friends are gay, essentially. To me, it's just, you know, the obverse, it's the flip side of the coin of saying, I don't like gay people. You're still making, as a tolerant liberal, a statement about yourself. And it can be uncomfortable. I mean, yeah, of course, it's, you know, better to be uncritically loved than beaten up, obviously. But I mean, what do you reckon?
Well, it's tricky. Look, I've experienced lots of different positive responses that come from different intentions. I mean, there's that liberal response, sure. My girlfriend and I also went and to one of Father Rod's sermons in Gosford. He's that radical pastor, just because we wanted to check it out. It was really Jesus-y, though, which was fine. But the
surprising,
surprisingly,
that you
Jesus-y.
Would encounter that in a place of Christian worship.
It's true. But we did find that at morning tea afterwards, everyone was very excited to have some gays. They were like, "Ooh, Father Rod went to Mardi Gras this year, did you know?" And so that was kind of nice. And the other positive experience, I have to say, big plug for my grandmother. She said when I had been in relationships with...
You've told me about your grandma.
Before. She's great. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about this. We could have
she's
a whole panel
a, she's
on
She's a
her.
Second wave feminist,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she's like a multi-feminist, many different views.
But original second wave.
Yeah, original, vintage. And when I was in relationships with men and then and I identify as queer, and she knew that. But when I got into a relationship with my current girlfriend, she said, "Oh, my gosh, we have to have a party." And that was really nice because I did experience some homophobia at that time, actually, some people that didn't really want to be friends anymore.
So it's like you know the concept, right, that homosexual is sort of regarded as hypersexual. You know what I mean? When a lot of people think of homosexual acts, they think of them as somehow extra sexual, like extremely sexual. You know what I mean, right? Yeah? Yeah, okay. So that makes sense. So we live in a time in the West where anything sexual, particularly those acts undertaken by women, are regarded as positive. It's sort of, you know, this whole psychoanalysis in reverse thing. It's like, you know, let your inner core be free and let's celebrate our sexuality. And a really another interesting way to look at it, so it's not just about homosexual people, but it's about, you know, all sexual acts, particularly those undertaken by women. So, 100 years ago, which masturbation for women was, and masturbation for men, but, you know, masturbation for women was, if it wasn't medicalised, and sometimes in the West, and you can go to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London and see, you know, devices that were supposed to both stop masturbation. You know, men used to put, bells on the penises of little middle-class Victorian boys in case they had nocturnal, anyway, you know what I mean. And then also, you know, have you seen all those old psychoanalytical tools like, vibrators for use by doctors to release the demons from within women? But, you know, mostly female masturbation, you know, like something that was really disgusting and not to be done, or at least something that was aberrant or something that needed to be controlled in a medical context. And so in the last 20 years, what we see are shows on Oprah about masturbation. So at one point in history, we have the ideology masturbation is bad. And obviously, I don't need to explain to you why that might be oppressive. And now, you know, I mean, Channel 4 in the UK has a whole week every year celebrating masturbation. And it seems to me, and, you know, there's all these, like, liberal feminists who write joyous columns teaching us how to masturbate, celebrate your orgasm. It's like, stay the fuck out of my orgasm, you know? Like, don't tell me that I should be experiencing these uterine paroxysms of joy. Don't tell me that I can't masturbate. Could we just not talk about it, perhaps? You know, could you just not codify my sexuality? Yeah, I have enough trouble with it as it is, for God's sake, you know. So that strikes me as, you know, analogous in some way. I mean, when you can actually get daytime television hostesses saying, it's great for women to masturbate, it's good for your skin, it's good for your health, it's good for your productivity at work. I mean, for God's sake, you know, it's like, you know, there's some things that don't have to be moralised about. And so the masturbation thing, does that make any jot of sense to you whatsoever?
It does. It really does.
Well, you're a sexuality theorist, so it probably would.
Well, it is very Foucauldian. Yeah. But I was going to ask, actually, I mean, there's a bit of masturbation in the book, to be fair.
There is. But I don't celebrate it. I mean, you wouldn't read my masturbation passages and think, oh, that's hot and horny. You'd think, oh, the poor old love. Oh, look at her there lying on the floor trying to get herself off. And she hasn't even had a shower.
You know. There was a lot of chicken carcasses involved around
it's
as
not,
well.
It's not a glorious celebration of masturbation. It's
That's
just,
true.
I mean, it's disgusting.
But I did notice in the book that you put in a lot of public service announcements.
I did.
I had one here that I liked. Slow down when you are looking for sex on the internet. Slow down to the point you might actually connect with a meaningful penis. So I was wondering, like, what...
That was in the penis search phase, yeah.
Yeah, so why the PSAs? What did you want people to take away from this?
I'm always amused by, like, I was around about your age when there was this show called Beverly Hills 90210 on the television, and I always had this kind of, like, because it was the 90s and everything was ironic, I had this ironic fondness for it, and they would often have public service announcements at the end. And I just find, you know, adopting that responsible tone is quite, you know, it sort of works as a writer because you drain your morality out of the rest of the text, and you have these times where you can explicitly say, well, this is what my morality is. You know, let me let this ideology out. Let me unmask, you know, my true moral prescriptions. So I find them quite funny, like, you know, kids, don't do drugs. And you and I have spoken... I won't go there. I was going to talk about safe schools. We better not talk about safe schools. Somebody will kill us, me particularly. But, you know, like, I always had this thing in school. Like, I was in school during this thing called the drug offensive. And there was all this just say no to drugs. You know, it was completely inadequate. And when children and teenagers do those compulsory exercises where you have somebody waggling a finger at you and there's no assessment, and you're supposed to sort of like absorb these moral lessons, I mean, most of the kids, or at least me, would say, oh, you know, get off the prawns, you know, like, I mean, you know, seriously, anything that figures in authority tell a certain kind of person, and I would say probably most kind of people, you know, we're profoundly cynical about them. So I just wanted to, I guess, you know, selfishly allow myself a space to be that wanker who's telling you how I think you should live your life. Also, I just wanted to actually give some hints for people who have just been dumped because it sucks. Have you been dumped ever?
I have. No, I have. And actually, the person that dumped me contacted me like a month ago on Facebook. This is like 10 years after dumping me the day before my birthday, and was like, would you like to catch up for a coffee? I hear you're in Melbourne and you're at the university. And I was like, no, block, no.
Yeah. Did you respond? Or?
No, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. Hi, if you're out there.
That's cool. Could they see that you read their message?
No, but I wondered if that would have been a good burn. I don't know.
I think a better burn is like message not yet viewed.
Yeah.
I think that's the best burn.
Yeah. So on that note, I mean, this book, it's a cathartic journey exploring.
I'm sorry. you know that we fine you $10 every time you use the word journey outside of MasterChef.
Damn. But how are we going to hero your book? I love that. I love that that's a thing. I watch MasterChef every day. But anyway, that's
everybody does.
That's another story. But, you know, what was it really hard to write this book? It's very emotional.
Post-breakup. No, I love talking about myself, as is plain. Wasn't. It was just, what wonderful thing can I disclose about my wonderful self to the needy readers of the nations of the world? No, I mean, no, like writing a book is, and I'm sure there's people here who've done it, you're in the process of finishing one, it's a pain in the arse. Like the bigness of the thing is terrible. But I'm not good for anything else. Can't see very well, so I can't be an Uber driver. That won't give me a licence. Those fascists. Just because I'm legally blind, there should be no hindrance to... So I can't do anything else, so I may as well write a book. And, you know, writing a book, you complain about it, but it's a huge indulgence. I mean, it's this intense sort of, you know, like, cultural privilege. It's not a right, it's a privilege to do this thing. So, like, in that sense, no. But, like, you know, I'm very devoted to myself. I've seen, you know, a lot of psychologists, taken a variety of pharmaceuticals, and, you know, I'd gone through the pain, and so turning it into a story is a privilege. So no, it wasn't hard to write a book, other than the fact that writing a book is annoying.
What about, did you get contacted by your ex after the book was released with any kind of...
No.
Oh, okay. What about, I mean, I wonder about writing about...
Had a barrister look it over, by the way.
Sorry?
I had a barrister look over the book.
Oh, right.
I also had an ethicist look over the book.
What did the ethicist say?
Oh, it's all right. It was a utilitarian ethicist. I don't know if we can trust these people. But I don't feel that, like, it was important to know from a, you know, personal finances standpoint, had I done anything illegal... unlawful. But from an ethical standpoint, I did give it to people that I trust, who were, au fait with, not just moral philosophy but political philosophy. And, what do you think? Have I gone too far? Like, I don't want to trash this person. And I don't think that I did.
No, I thought it was very generous considering the circumstances.
There are about 10,000 missing words, but...
When in the, like, 10-year anniversary, you can include them as, like, the extra chapter.
No. The barrister didn't like those ones.
Okay. So, I mean, you do kind of reflect a lot of your friends and your encounters and chats with your friends in this. And one friend that I found really interesting was your feminist friend who was very dismayed. She was a heterosexual woman, as I understand from your book, who was very dismayed that you wanted to now have casual sex with
men. She wasn't a close friend.
Okay.
Right? And I'm betting you've actually probably met the real woman in real life. She's very nice, but just so she's a heterosexual kind of, like, you know, liberal feminist with leftish tendencies. And, you know, she's just all very, you were asking, she wasn't happy about me having heterosexual urges.
What is that attitude?
But it's like we were talking about before. I mean, you know, yes, it was great that your grandma gave you a party. For, you know, the brave and noble act of licking another woman's vagina. But I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that to you. You're so sweet. Look at her sweet face.
She would love that. I mean, she's probably going to listen to a tape of this and be like... Yes.
What's her name?
Ruth. Hi, Ruth.
Say hi, Ruth. Hi, Ruth. Yeah. while those things are nice, as I was saying before, there are many people who are... And also she's... was, and I'm sure still is, like a very, you know, activist feminist. And I guess she felt she'd spent so much time volunteering for rape crisis lines and doing women-only activity, and I've always been, like, you know, a commentator rather than an activist, that she felt the least I could do for the feminist struggle was have girl-on-girl sex. You know, if I wasn't going to advocate for women-only spaces, I'd better be inside women-only spaces. Is that, but, you know, know. You know what it's like. You just get a few kind of like, you know, like Femo brownie points if you're a Liz.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that I've noticed with a lot of feminists who are in relationships with men who are like, you know, sad about it. So,
like, I mean, you know, seriously, having sex with a woman isn't bad. It's quite good, right?
Yeah.
What are they complaining about? You know, I mean, either you know, jump on the penis or don't. You know, it's. I mean, seriously, it's fine. It's all fine.
So on this question of sexuality, I mean, it's really refreshing, I think, in your book to kind of have this, you know, this journey through,
Hannah!
You know, different sexual partners and kind of, I mean, there's some really interesting encounters that you have with people who, you know, a man who identifies as a gay man. Hmm. And to me, it really challenges the way that we talk about sexuality in these very kind of, you know, concrete, bounded ways.
Okay, but the way that we talk in public about sexuality, like the, and particularly, you know, I mean, both you and I have had conversations in the past where we're, you know, we're both feminists, we've both had a commitment to feminism that seems to have occurred before the onset of our womanhood or adulthood, and we find ourselves in a moment which is broadly regarded by many as feminism's most glorious and widespread moment, yet we feel a lot of disagreement with that. And part of the reason that I am annoyed by it is that, you know, there is this sort of propagandist decision, like, you know, tanky Soviet style, to be part of the united front, that you must not criticise feminists. I mean, I've spoken to, like, quite prominent feminists before who have made an ethical point never to criticise another woman. And, you know, when that comes down to Theresa May or Hillary Clinton, you know, invading Libya and applauding the death by... I won't even tell you how Gaddafi was killed, but because it's too horrific. You know, when she... So you're not permitted to critique any women. This is the kind of the unified front. I'm sorry, what was the question?
It was actually a question about sexuality, but...
Oh, okay.
I'm really interested...
Yeah. How we talk in public and how we talk in private. So, you know, and it's the same with LGBTIQA stuff. It's like, you know, there was a recent thing that some of you guys might have seen where a News Corp journalist was, you know, got some tweets from some older activists who identify as gay men. And they were like, well, you know, and so this guy was on the New South Wales branch of the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. And these two guys were saying he shouldn't be on it because he's involved with News Corp, which is part of a wider frustration that many people, particularly older queers, have in the community, that, you know, organisations that have oppressed us, still oppress us, in the case of, you know, NewsCon, by saying disgusting things, you know, now we're embracing, you know, the finance sector and Coca-Cola and whomever, and, you know, a lot of people have some discomfort with that. Now, these guys, guys without any real public profile, said, you know, and not using the most pleasant language, but said, you know, you shouldn't be, this guy shouldn't be on the board. And this became news. All over News Corp. It was one of the most viewed stories of the day. It was like gay bullies. And, you know, you have people like Lee Sales tweeting, we can't have this kind of dissent. You know, one person shouldn't be victimised. But the real issue is who is advocating within our community? Why is it being overtaken by people who have cool jobs, by people who sit on finance sector boards, by people who actively work against our interests? So the public discourse is and must be, oh, we're all agreed. But the private discourse is we're not all agreed and we're very strange. And it's the same about sex. So we talk about sex like I'm sexually liberated and blah, 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 and, you know, all sex is great except the kind that isn't. And this is how queer people present now. But in private, amongst ourselves, we don't talk that way at all. And lesbians have sex with gay men, and women are always showing gay blokes their tits. Like, it just happens. It's a rite of passage. If you haven't done it, I highly recommend it. He'll give you an honest assessment of their quality. And so these are the things that happen. You know, this is the way. I've just realised I'm about to quote a line from the L Word theme song. I was about to say, this is the way that we live. God, I hate that show so much, but I watched it all twice.
I never watched the last season. But...
Oh, no. Well, it was kind of good because it was Jenny was dead. I can't believe I got applause for saying that Jenny was dead. But how bad was Jenny? But this is, you know, this is how queer life, when there used to be more of a, I mean, I don't want to be things were better in the old days. They weren't all better in the old days. But there were more stable, thickly bonded networks of care. I'm talking specifically about where I grew up as an adult, which, you know, where I attained the full flower of my adulthood that you see before you, which was in inner city Sydney around Newtown and Darlinghurst, the big gay suburbs that were still then, you know, affordable. And you had things like, you know, you had drag mothers. And now people are encouraged not to identify as drag queens anymore, even if that's been their identity. You know, it's like, well, you identify as trans, please. And there's not, to my knowledge, the number of drag houses where older women, or if they prefer to identify, drag queens, would teach younger women / drag queens how to dress, and very often financially support them. Another thing, there was a hotel on Oxford Street, which was a gay hotel, and the gay publicans, you know how in New South Wales you have to have rooms in a hotel for some bizarre licensing reason, like you have to have rooms for lodging in pubs. And in all of these rooms were older gay men, some with alcohol problems, some managing HIV, who basically had signed over their power of attorney to these gay blokes. And, you know, they served them drinks and made sure that they could live in a way that they couldn't have found elsewhere. Now, of course, the state should look after all of that stuff, but the state doesn't. And so there's, you know, dozens of examples I can think about, very unconventional financial and sexual arrangements that happened in queer culture and still go on in queer culture. And we don't want to talk about them now. I mean, you know, the best example I can think of is, you know, there was a queer Q&A. Did you see it?
I didn't see it.
Did anyone see the queer Q&A?
I stopped watching that show a while ago. Yeah.
But little lovely Tom Ballard, who's a great guy, he hosted it. Did any of you guys see it? Yeah. And so, you know, Julie Macross, and, you know, bless everything, says, well, you know, I'm here to tell you that I'm a normal, I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember the exact quote, I'm a normal picket fence lesbian, and most of us are like this. And I'm like, fuck no, we're not. You know, I mean, sure, maybe, okay, maybe, you know, a majority of people do, increasingly less so. I mean, a majority of people are able to fit in and so do fit in, but there's many of us who don't. And there's many of us who don't want that, and there's many people who simply can't afford it. You know, I mean, you know, we used to be worried about rent boys, right? I mean, sorry, that's probably a completely unacceptable phrase. Male sex workers. I'm sorry, I'm old. It's a thing that used to be acceptable to say, and the naming that a lot of the men would choose for themselves. We don't give a shit about male sex workers anymore. We don't give a shit about homeless youth. We give a shit about the right to marriage. And I don't care. Have the right to marriage. It's fine, whatever. But, you know, all of the passion, all of the funding, all of the enthusiasm in queer culture has drained out of it and become this fight. And we have things like, you know, you see people say, well, they have the right to marry in Alabama, but we don't have it here. You know, I mean, Okay, well, they also have capital punishment in Alabama. The other thing about America is that, look, I could go on forever about this, but I won't because I'll probably bore a lot of you, and I know that most people are, like, very passionately attached to the idea of having their relationship status enshrined in law, despite the fact that in 2008 there was over 100 pieces of legislation changed to enable people in same-sex relationships to have the same, and people in unmarried opposite-sex relationships to have the same rights as people who are married. But, you know, still people really want this piece of paper and they want the imprimatur of the state. Okay, fine, I understand that. I don't want to impose my will on you, but I want to remind you again and again that where there are other struggles and there are other ways of being other than...
Well, I mean, you raise a lot of really difficult questions about how we should orient towards this question of, you know, same-sex marriage, for example. And I don't think there's an easy answer to it, for me at least. I think, you know, it's unclear that if we had same-sex marriage in Australia that it wouldn't have all these other ramifications where there'd be more space to talk about other things or, I mean, I see at the moment, you know, a lesbian couple that I know are having a baby and the partner can't get parental leave that would be equivalent to
what
a man would get.
I believe that might be unlawful.
No. I mean, they've got lawyers and things onto it. It's just because it's at the discretion of their HR manager. So it's like...
But that's the thing. So many things are at the discretion of companies now, right? Yeah, but, I mean, that's terrible.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that when you have that legal framework that provides some sense of legitimacy in a really broad mainstream way, that it might ease other things that are happening for people as well, just in terms of understanding that same-sex relationships are equal.
Yeah, yeah. Equality is a problematic concept, to use the parlance of the young. It really is, you know. It's like that old thing that I'm sure your grandma like stood under as a banner: equality is aiming too low. I mean, you know, there were many, many pieces of legislation, you know, from, you know, real estate acts, taxation acts, workplace agreement acts, where, you know, for example, now it's illegal to deny somebody bereavement leave, and it has been since 2008. Which actually, you know, we should mention is the work of the gay and lesbian rights lobby, the federal mob. And, you know, so it's very disheartening to hear this. I don't know if those rights would be automatically conferred, though, because of marriage.
No, I understand. I mean, I'm totally hearing your argument.
Should have time off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, lots of people should have a lot more time off for having babies anyhow. But, so, look, I understand. I mean, and people want it. And some people dream of getting married their entire lives, and it's fine, and I don't have any objections to it. But, you know, when you hear... And I saw something the other day saying that youth suicide rates amongst LGBTIQA people have dropped dramatically in the US since the Supreme Court. You know, okay. So I'm sorry. Do you have sexuality reports with autopsies now? Like you don't have your sexuality printed on your certificate of death. There is actually no way to know that. What we can know is that LGBTIQA people tend to experience suicidality in greater numbers. We don't know how many more of them actually, you know, do that. And I'm sorry to talk about this thing without giving you a, you know, trigger warning, which is actually a great phrase that the youngsters have given us. But this is a very big... You know, it's a very big and emotional thing. You say we've got to pass it because, you know, it'll stop people from hurting themselves. I think that is a very spurious claim. Interestingly, it's one that's often been used by a particular contingent in the queer communities. Like, we must have this to stop young people from hurting themselves.
Mm.
And it's seriously? Like, can't we have this because it's just?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, like that's an impossible thing to prove. You know, I mean, it may be true, but it's an impossible thing to prove. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying and what have you, but to say that this is the great moral struggle of a time, like, I don't normally like her writing, but I saw Fran Lebowitz say something about, well, you know, the entire fixation is on getting into the military and getting married. And I think that that says a lot. And, you know, if you go to Mardi Gras in Sydney these days, you know, the famous Coca-Cola sign on King's Cross lights up in rainbow colours, and people talk about this as though it's a victory. And, you know, you go to one of the four big banks and their ATMs, you know, congratulate you for being gay. Who gives a shit? You know, it's not your... It's sort of like the whole thing with... you know, this expectation that if companies are good, then the world will be better. Well, companies will be good if it's good for their bottom line, and they'll be bad if it's good for their bottom line. That's not a moral judgment about them. It's just to say that their only morality is profit, and it has to be. Otherwise, they're not companies for very long. So, you know, like, seeking the endorsement of the state and big business is something that troubles me. So I just want to push people, you know, away from thinking. Actually, some of the things that we've invented for ourselves, actually some of the curious networks of care that we have, are not things that we should abandon, but things that we should fight to impose on the rest of the world, because these are good things. And I mean, you know, to be like a radical nut bar about it, yes, there should be polyamorous marriage if we're going to talk for marriage. There should be arrangements in law. And why does marriage have to be the be-all and end-all? Like, why does, you know, the possibility that you might have, you know, you haven't experienced lesbian bed death and you do, you know, Laverne and Shirley syndrome, and, you know, you do continue to have a sexual relationship, why can't people have other arrangements, you know, like, you know, between people who care and people who receive the care? There's all kinds of love, there's all kinds of human relationships, and they're not just gay or straight.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really got that sense from your book, that you know, you were really communicating this about sexuality. And
but it's a fun read.
It is fun.
It's fun.
There's a cat. I think that's the real love story, actually.
The cat is the Mr. Darcy of the book.
But in terms of this collectivism that you're talking about, these different ways of thinking about sexuality and arranging ourselves, how are we going to get there? What's the plan? What do you think?
I would say smash the capitalist system would be a good start.
Yeah.
And then we can see what kind of prejudice we're left with after that.
Will we be left with prejudice? That's the big
question. Yeah, of course. I mean, of course. Like, at no point does Marx say, and everything is fixed, you know, like... This is no, like, you know, socialism is just the shadow of capitalism. Socialism just tries to investigate... those social relations that capitalism governs. I don't think it governs all of them. I think it has a bit of an effect on all of them as well. It's a complex question, one that he failed to answer over perhaps a million published words.
So you identify as a Marxist?
Yes.
And?
This is one identity label I will accept.
What is it like being a Marxist in 2017, do you think?
Well, after today, a little bit less embarrassing.
Okay.
Okay. No, seriously, I mean, it's interesting. So 5 years ago, I mean, part of... Look, you guys might have found this when you've been dumped as well. Like, you maybe have this return to the things that informed you in your youth or your childhood. When you are dumped, you look for a foundation, you know, some sort of like philosophical or religious foundation maybe. And, you know, on the advice of a very good friend of mine who's Muslim, she, you know, she said, well, you could try that, you know. And then she's also a scholar, and she said, but, you know, you'd probably be more comfortable just like burrowing yourself back into Marxism. And I took her advice. You know, I was also sort of liberated being on my own to really investigate those ideas. And so this is like about 5 years ago, and I started, you know, reading Capital again and, you know, reading other Marxists and thinking, gee, this makes a lot of sense. So, you know, especially, you know, if you read about the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, or you read about a time where innovation would slow down, a time where the urbanised, formerly bourgeois class would find themselves as part of the, you know, precariat or the working class, like a time where we were all fucked, which is now. And so it was a very interesting time to start reacquainting myself with these texts. And then about a year ago, I got more work than I could poke a stick at. Like, people were like, we need a Marxist view here. You know, what's the socialist perspective? It's like, seriously? And, you know, people are wanting to know it, and particularly people in your age range. Mm-hmm. And I got so many, because you guys, I mean, you know, I mean, I know you went to ANU and I know you were taught Marxism by a friend of mine. And Rick Kuhn, a wonderful Marxist, very orthodox, don't get into an argument with him. But, you know, that's quite a rare experience. You're not taught Marxism at university. And I don't think Rick is teaching any longer. And so you guys, I mean, you're an exception, but mostly you guys, you know, in your early 30s, late 20s, never heard of it. You never had it explained. And also you've got, like, loony left-wing parents as well who would have given you, which is awesome and part of the reason that you're awesome. I know her parents. It's so depressing. And so a lot of people in your age range are like, okay, well, they talk to the Uber drivers and they realise that the Uber drivers have this terrible life. Mm. And they're thinking about where their clothes are made, and they're thinking about, I owe a lot of money for my education, which I can probably never pay back. And, you know, they find themselves in a downturn of capitalism, and they're looking for explanations. And I started getting so many emails and Facebook messages from kids, you know, sorry, you're a kid, saying, you know, but you would never ask me this question because you know the answer to it, asking me, Mummy, what is Marxism? And so I wrote a book about it. Like, and to my shock, a major publisher, the same publisher, Alan and Unwin, said, oh, yeah, sure, you can write 60,000 words on explaining Marx to millennials. And I think it's going to sell reasonably well because people are quite curious. So your question was, and curiously I remember it, what's it like being a Marxist? A little bit less embarrassing than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And
a little bird told me that you've been reading Lenin.
Oh my gosh! Yes.
Oh no, I mean, some of, you know, forget what the guy, you know, did or didn't do. Some of his writing is magnificent.
No, I'm like that far away from getting a Lenin tattoo. Like, it's that, like, it's that bad. But it's
Vlad was pretty great.
You have to work through a lot of things with Stalin and stuff. So before we can talk about Lenin,
he died in 1923. He doesn't know what went on after that.
But before we get too deep down that rabbit hole, I'd like to open up to the Q&A.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Hannah. When you come to talk about your book at the Wheeler Centre, can I ask you questions?
That would be amazing. Oh. So we're going to have
irritating.
we have two roving mics, and we'll just start with the first question. If anyone's keen, they'll find you.
I was wondering if both of you are going to go to the tennis and buy tickets and sit in Margaret Court Arena.
I heard that Sigur Rós is going to do a protest concert there. Did you hear that?
At the tennis because of...
Because of Margaret Court.
Oh, I don't... Idgaf? I don't care.
Don't you care? I care.
About the naming of it?
Well, you know, it's like the symbolism of gay, you know, same-sex marriage. It's... it means something.
I object to everything. Melbourne shouldn't be called Melbourne. I just object to it all. Like... I should just get that tattooed. I mean, I just object to it all. It's all screw. I mean, look, she's... I know, I don't care. I don't care. Sigur Rós, that's some powerful music that'll really stir people on to revolutionary action. Seriously. Yeah. No, I'll want to... I don't care. I don't care about Barilla pasta. I don't...
Oh, it's so delicious. It makes me so sad.
You, as a homosensual, you cannot eat it because apparently, you know, do you remember this thing? You know, it's like, another day. What are people angry about on Facebook today? One day they were angry because the pasta for the prize. It's quite good. You know, he was asked would he ever feature a same-sex couple in his advertisements. He answered no. And so people boycotted Perilla Pasta.
And I was one of those people.
Oh, God, really? Why?
But I'm a vegetarian. Like, you know, it's the same thing. But, I mean...
Yeah, you can't boycott your way out of fucking capitalism, no. Hannah. Jesus! Or homophobia, for that matter. I mean, you know, like, if we're going to take this, like, is your supply chain clean attitude to every organisation in the world... You know, when you want a homophobia test for every product that you put into your body. Like, there's going to be somebody homophobic who touched the product that you are consuming at some point, you know. But, I mean, you know, I understand. I mean, bless you. You're very sweet.
Just being honest.
I don't know anything about tennis. I'm legally blind. I can't see the ball. I don't give a shit. You know, I mean, she seems to be, you know, like a little bit unfortunate, doesn't she?
So I think the answer to that question was no.
But, I mean, you know, the other thing for me is that, you know, the real danger, we look at the, you know, the alt-right, the extreme homophobe, the open racist, right? We relentlessly cover people who oftentimes, I'm no doctor, surprisingly, but, you know, who seem to have mental ill health doing racist rants on public transport, you know, and if, like me, you do take a lot of public transport, you realise that, you know, there's a lot of low-income people and a lot of tension on public transport. So we blame these people. We cover them relentlessly. We look at people whose views are largely unacceptable anyway. We give rise to it. We amplify it. We actually normalise it a good deal more than it's already normalised, and we say this is the true problem. No, that's not the true problem. The true problem are, you know, the centrists saying that this is the true problem. So it's sort of like in America, right, a nation of which I'm sure you've heard. Perhaps you know of this little fellow bag of circus peanuts called Donald Trump. Now, people see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as opposed. I mean, actually, the politics are mere millimetres away. There's just a little window dressing. So one person is offering imperialistic neoliberalism with racist and sexist language. One person is offering imperialistic neoliberalism without the racist and sexist language. All we focus on is the absence or the presence of the racist or sexist language. The two reactions to a period of consensus where we all just agree that the centre is the right way and that the quiet tolerance of everybody is the right way, the two reactions is the extreme right and the extreme left. I prefer the latter. And these are both reactions produced by the hegemony, you know, and it's all produced by capitalism. Is it hegemony or hegemony?
I don't know.
I don't think anyone does.
We should...
ask Antonio Gramsci.
We should have another question, though, to be fair to the audience.
I'd rather just talk. Sorry. No.
Have we got another one? Another question?
I didn't catch how much of a delay you had between before your relationship and then dating again after it.
It was about 6 hours.
No. I mean... How long since you had dated before that is what I'm getting at.
Oh, 15 years. Yeah.
To how you found that change? What seemed different in particular?
Well, you know, I'm sorry if I'm not looking at you because I can't see you. It's because I'm a poor little blind girl. Everything changes when you're dumped. So it just like your whole world seems to have no foundation. So, but I guess you're asking what has changed in the dating world since in that time. Yeah, is that what you're asking? Yeah. Well, obviously the you know, you have the things on your phone which are just like Uber but for sexually transmitted infections. So that is huge. Like that's a huge difference. And also, are you around my age, good sir? Your voice would indicate so.
I'm probably a little older.
Oh, no. Well, what a shame I didn't find you at the time. okay, so, you know, so say we're about the same age. When we were kids, right, there was... Australians would probably bring up a little sick if they were asked to use the term dating. There was no dating culture in the Australia of the 70s, 80s and 90s. There was merely drinking too much alcohol, trying not to vomit and hopefully falling upon somebody with which you had something vaguely in common. And so, you know, the interesting and the really pleasant thing, I think, about the technology and how it's changed the culture is that now people go on dates. And so you do have this kind of like more ritualized, more like, you know, US style of actually going on an adventure together. At least that was, you know, sort of my experience being, and I think it was most people's experience, whether sort of like working class or middle class, there wasn't really a dating culture. So the fact that, you know, it's now not so embarrassing to go on a date is really good. I mean, I honestly think that it's done nothing but improve. I'm being positive about the present. Isn't that nice?
It's good to hear. Would you say that there's a particular like method of, you know, dating, like Tinder or going to speed dating? What worked best?
Actually, you know, probably Twitter gave me the most sex of any app.
Wow.
You know, there was this how just I met people on Twitter and had sex with them. It's like not very complex.
I thought there might be a hashtag or something.
No, I was more like, who wants to root me? Deleted those tweets. But it was like somebody I heard recently that there is an app that's not available in Australia yet, but it's an app which brings people together based on their mutual loathings for things. I believe you call it leitmotif in my important literary work. is about how much I hate Coldplay, the band Coldplay. I regard them as, you know, gelid evil. U2 comes a close second. And it was very important to me that my sexual partners would also hate Coldplay. And, I mean, I really hate Coldplay. It's just such a bad band. And, like, even rejected by Gwyneth, that's how bad they are. So there is this app that actually codifies that, you know, you can meet somebody based on this, on hating the same things. That's basically what Twitter was at the time. I don't think that there's so much romantic action going on Twitter. But they change all the time. I mean, I have a very good young friend, even younger than you, and she met just the most adorable man, and they're still together on Tinder. But this was, you know, Tinder in its beta phase. And so now I'm told that Tinder has changed a lot and that people apprehend it in a different way. So, I mean, you know, it depends. I would say try everything, you know, be introduced to people by your friends, you know, try Tinder, try whatever, really. Go to a speed dating thing. Stand in the middle of a pub and say, root me, I don't know. Don't do that, obviously.
You might meet someone in the line for the book signing tonight.
I'm now spoken for.
Yeah. So how was that? Can you hint whether it was someone that was in the book, or
it may be someone who was in the book?
Oh, that's exciting. So will there be a sequel?
No. No one will. No. No one gives a
shit.
I
would read it. I definitely.
Thank you, sweetie. But you know,
I wanted to know.
This is only because I applaud you and retweet you all the time. You know, it's not a literary decision you're making. It's a personal one. I'll just send you emails. No, there doesn't need to be a sequel. And, you know, I shouldn't have even said that because, I mean, I didn't want it to be resolved. I didn't want there to be a happy ending or an end to a journey or anything, because that's not what real life is like. It's an ongoing struggle between the id and civilization. Has anyone seen the new Twin Peaks, speaking of that, yet? Yeah, it's great, right?
One person.
It's crazy. No, I totally recommend it. I totally recommend it. I mean, it is, you know, to call it Lynchian is not sufficient.
We've got 1 minute left. Is there any other questions?
I've listened to you on Triple J.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mutated your mind when you were, I think, probably about 3 or 4.
You're hilarious. Very, very funny.
It's true.
Quite, quite.
Sorry.
What are your thoughts about women being called girls?
Oh, I just call ladies a range of things, including ladies or dames or broads or... I mean, you know, it depends. If a member of the Institute for Public Affairs called me a girl, I'd say, don't call me a girl! But my friends call me a girl and, I mean, you know, the whole distinction girl is quite strange. You know, I don't really mind. I mean, it depends who's saying it, you know. If it is intended as a slur, then I'll probably get all hoity-toity. You know, I don't... I mean, I think, you know, it is somewhat infantilizing, and I don't know whether you're asking me, because it's used very popularly in the context of contemporary feminism. And it's, you know... And I think it's kind of interesting where the new popularity of the word girl, the new legitimacy amongst feminists came from. It actually, you know, like the United Nations loves using the word girl and has many programs to empower girls. How exactly they're going to empower girls when, you know, the US is also, you know, drone striking these girls is beyond me. But I look, neither here nor there, really. Would you prefer if I took an extreme position? I can.
Well, we'll have to catch you on Twitter for that extreme position or at the signing desk.
I'm banned from it. I'm banned from it for the next... I banned myself for the next 2 weeks.
Oh, no, it's a
perfect
time.
I had a Corbyn explosion today, so... No social media for me. Like, I totally recommend not following me on any form of social media and yourself abstaining from social media, particularly when you're angry about something. Give me an email or something. We can have a quiet argument between ourselves.
Well... You should definitely buy Helen's book if
you don't
not follow
to.
Her on social media.
Don't follow
She's
me.
She's got a book
on social
coming
media.
Out at the end
don't
of the year.
Don't encourage me.
Total Propaganda, Basic Marxist Training for the Angry and the Young. So that's something to look forward to.
Yes, just in time for the centenary of the glorious October Uprising. It's 2017. You know what happened in 1917, didn't you? All went very well for about 5 minutes.
And I just have to point out that Hares and Hyenas are selling copies of the Helen 100 off
I am
the back.
So stoked about that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thanks, Hares and Hyenas. And thank
I
you,
Helen.
I took
a picture of it when you put it in your window. I was like, see? I've always wanted to be in the window of Hares and Hyenas. I'm sorry, I'll shut up now.
Sorry. I was just going to say thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed chatting to you.
Thank you for accepting my invitation to come here.
So let's all thank Helen.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.